dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, I'm going to begin by reading a couple of more essays from the book Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, A Book of History and Strategy, published by the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. The point of the authors is to define democracy in terms of real power, not the trappings of decision-making represented by the existence of elections that occur within a framework of laws that prevent anyone elected actually challenging the real locus of power, which now rests in the hands of giant corporations. They assert that what we actually have in this country is corporate rule, and that people must organize to overthrow it by sweeping away the legal foundation on which it rests. Are disparities of wealth the cause of political inequality or the result? This is an important question for those wishing to attack the problem. It's a difficult one to unravel so far down the road in the process of corporate feudalism. The latter half of the program will feature a talk by political scientist Susan George, who is focused on attacking the power through the money, whereas it seems to me the writers of Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy are focused on attacking the money through the power. Different political approaches to addressing the state of affairs, which they are unanimous in condemning. The first essay I'm going to read to you this week is titled Playing by Whose Rules? A Challenge to Environmental, Civil Rights, and Other Activists by Richard L. Grossman. With few exceptions, people come out of law school without having questioned pro-corporate doctrines on property. For example, future profits on corporate property, the fruits of employee labor are corporate property, the right to manage is corporate property, etc. They accept today's giant corporations as inevitable. They don't seem to wonder how it came to pass that corporations became legal persons with free speech and other constitutional rights, while workers on company turf have no Bill of Rights protections. They do not encourage the rest of us to ask why a sovereign people should permit corporate legal fictions to elect our representatives, write and pass our laws, or lie to the public on vital issues. Environmental and labor lawyers are trained to not challenge prevailing assumptions about the law and to accept current legal doctrines. And then they train us. Corporate lawyers, government lawyers, environmental lawyers, all have been funneling people's time, energy, and resources into stacked deck regulatory and administrative law arenas where even if we, quote, win, we don't win much, and where there are few mechanisms we can use to shift rights and powers from corporations to people, communities, and nature. Movement lawyers should take their cues from activists on the ground. Local organizers should say, such and such investment and production are destructive, uneconomical, and wrong, but are protected by law and therefore by government. We will educate and organize to stop these harm doers. We need you lawyers to figure out how we can use the law and the courts to help us, or at least not to block us. Please don't lecture us about what we can't do. Don't come up with legal strategies which enable corporations to hide behind the privileges and immunities which corporations have taken from the people. And please don't tie our hands. Today's leading environmental law groups, such as the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, were formed 20 to 30 years ago, mostly by young men just out of law school. When these men were law students, the critical legal studies movement was not yet a presence within law schools. So as students, they were not exposed to even the modest questioning of curriculum and law professor biases, which goes on in some law schools today. Some of these environmental law groups received immediate support and financing from powerful philanthropies like the Ford and Rockefeller Foundation, and from law firms which represent large corporations. Today, these groups define the agenda of environmentalism. They drive much of the environmental movement towards permitting and disclosure laws administered by federal and state regulatory and administrative agencies. Each wave of environmental activists has had to confront these legal groups eager to stop us from making investment and production decision-making a more public process. Instead, they have sought to determine acceptable amounts of corporate poisons and corporate clear cuts, and to win compensation for corporate harms. They would have the public give greater profits to corporate leaders to encourage them to act more responsibly. As a result, we've seen campaign after campaign for citizen authority over corporations diverted into regulatory agencies and the courts, where activists toe the line of managerial prerogative and other claimed corporate property rights. As an anti-nuclear organizer in 1974, working to stop the construction of new nukes and to shut down existing nukes, not make nukes, quote, safe, and to revise the legal relationship between people and energy corporations, I vividly recall the hostility I encountered in Washington, D.C., when I inquired what help some of these groups would give us. I was astonished at their reaction, and it took some time before I began to understand it. In fact, most popular struggles, labor, civil rights, environmental, have been taken out of the public hands. Trade unionists allow their rights as organizers to be defined not by the power they could wield, but by the National Labor Relations Act. Years of protest by civil rights activists ended up with federal laws like the Voting Rights Act, which are much less than what people had organized and died for. Decades ago, the American people accepted the alarms of activists and said, okay, we want clean air, clean water, wild lands preserved as national parks, forests, and wilderness areas. Our movement lawyers and corporate lawyers wrote the laws. What did we get? Law which legalized the poisoning of the air and water, which legalized clear-cutting, which left unchallenged the privilege and immunities which corporations had usurped during the past century, and which concentrated power in the hands of appointed regulators and administrators, insulated from our reach. Today, our regulatory and administrative laws are a stacked deck, granting corporations legal clout while disadvantaging peoples, communities, and nature. The National Environmental Policy Act does not mention corporations and requires nothing of corporations. The Taft-Hartley Act was written by corporate lawyers. Yet our environmental and labor lawyers let those laws define our arena of struggle, our aspirations, and our strategies. And now we let the lawyers shape what and how we think. So much hope has been invested in creating, enforcing, and reforming these diversionary laws. So much time, energy, and resources. look at the roles in energy policy played by the Environmental Defense Fund, the National Resources Defense Council, and the Conservation Law Foundation. Under the banners of demand-side management and energy efficiency, these groups, with philanthropic assistance and cover, have helped utility corporations get higher rates of return and decrease the powers of state public utility commissions to direct utility corporation executives to act. They have helped utility executives move decision-making behind closed doors, all in exchange for some pathetically minute voluntary corporation conservation efficiency investments. Utility corporations such as the Pacific Gas and Electric Company and Southern California Edison Corporation, regulated monopolies which by law are required to serve the public interest, took their extra profits and set up subsidiary corporations in other countries to build big new fossil burners. Their executives flood state capitals in Washington, D.C. with money to turn our elected officials against citizens' agendas. They spread their lies and intimidate people as they frame what little semblance of public policy debate we have. Now they're backing off from their energy efficiency promises because they smell bigger profits from new energy wheeling laws they wrote and enacted. And environmental law organizations remain these utility corporations' biggest offenders. Over the past 25 years, environmental lawyers have been assuring the American people that with each new law, the air and water and wilderness were being protected, that our children's health was being protected, that we were on the path to using energy efficiently and cleanly, not to worry. Snookered as we have been, we have not challenged corporations' claimed constitutional rights to make all the important investment and production decisions. We have not made people's constitutional rights in economic and employment decision-making a movement goal, or place this on our legal agenda. No wonder the public is vulnerable to corporate agitation and their, quote, wise use creatures inciting environmental and governmental backlash. In the decades before the 1870s, the corporation was treated by the public, its creator, as a subordinate institution. At that time, both law and popular culture reflected that the use of natural resources, the commons, was very much a realm of public decisions. But railroad, banking, mining, grain, and land speculative corporations began to steal the public lands and resources in vast amounts and to change the law. Today, corporations exercise governing roles as they direct massive amounts of capital, control jobs, production, trade, technology, and property. They dominate our elections, write and pass our laws, educate our judges in jurisprudence, shape public policy debate. Corporations exert influence on law schools, law professors, law students, on our educational system, and on our culture as a whole. The classic study of, quote, bedrock law is by Harvard Law School professor Morton Horowitz. It is called, appropriately, the transformation of American law, for that is precisely what corporate lawyers succeeded in doing by the end of the 19th century. Another scholar, Martin Sklar, called it a corporate reorganization of the property production system. This is what corporate leaders have been perfecting all during the 20th century. It is what we face today. Environmental and labor lawyers have placed our movement's hopes in regulatory and administrative agencies and in appeals courts. In these political arenas, they work hard to limit corporate harms one by one, corporation by corporation. But the history of such laws suggests that starting with the Interstate Commerce Act in 1887 and the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890, they were used to divert angry people who had been organizing to get power over corporations. Just at the time when the Supreme Court was bestowing legal personhood upon corporations, corporations were working children to death and using convicts to break strikes. Carnage prevailed in the nation's mines and mills. By the 1890s, railroad corporations were killing 6,000 to 7,000 people a year and injuring over 30,000 people a year, employees, passengers, and just people who happened to get in the way. The owners of Western railroad corporations had walked off with 180 million acres of public land. Federal judges were declaring unions to be criminal conspiracies. Corporate and government troops were bloodying and killing working people and Native Americans who dared to organize for their lives, liberties, rights, and pursuits of happiness. The working people and small business people who organized the Knights of Labor and the farmers, urban workers, small merchants, and intellectuals who built the populist movement sought ownership and control of railroads, banks, grain, and telegraph corporations because they realized that federal regulatory laws and agencies would become barriers between corporations and the people. They understood they needed democratic money and an end to the crop lien system so they could break the grip of cotton merchants, of tool and seed suppliers. They sought cooperation, cooperatives, and sufficiency instead of competition, hierarchy, and maximum production of everything. They struggled but were defeated by the combined might of the state and the corporate class. After their defeat, claims to rights and powers by corporate executives were legitimated by legal doctrine, law, court, historians, and law schools. Populists left us important legacies, but the reality of those legacies has been distorted. Regulatory laws were declared great victories for the people. And for the past century, citizen struggles for justice have been channeled into regulatory and administrative law realms and to the market, as if those are arenas where a sovereign people may redress grievances or define a nation's values. We have been playing too long by the rules of corporate exploiters and destroyers, by the rules they taught our lawyers, who have taught us as well. That article, Playing by Whose Rules, a challenge to environmental civil rights and other activists by Richard L. Grossman, from the book, Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy. Our next article, also by Richard L. Grossman, is Ending Corporate Governance. Today, few places on earth are free from corporate rule. Every day, people are bravely resisting corporations. They are standing up to the bullying, blackmail, and violence corporate managers use to maintain their grip over our minds, our work, and our communities. Yet most people still concede to corporations the broad property and constitutional rights which corporate leaders over the last century have claimed as their own. These rights disadvantage us every time we petition our elected officials, regulatory agencies, or courts for justice. They enable corporations to use bastardized democratic rhetoric and our own governments to keep us smartly in line. We have been trained to accept elected legislators and judges delegating our historical and constitutional sovereign authority over corporations to faceless institutions further and further away from our communities. Even when corporations cause blood to run, national citizens groups generally limit their goals to curbing corporate excesses or to requesting corporate managers to please act responsibly. While such efforts are important, they do not reduce significantly the destruction of communities, nature, and democracy by corporate leaders. Resistance to corporate harms, which does not challenge the legitimacy of corporate rule, Valiant as such resistance may be, does not appreciably change the corporate laws or constitutional doctrines which bestow upon giant corporations our government's support. It does not shift to people, communities, and nature the power and authority over elections, lawmaking, and legal proceedings which corporations have consolidated over the past 100 years. Indeed, the abdication of our social responsibilities as sovereign people has enabled many corporations chartered in our states to become larger in financial terms than most countries. The largest 300 corporations counted above 1/4 of all the goods producing assets in the world. The largest 100 have incomes greater than half the member countries of the United Nations. 70% of all international trade is directed by 500 corporations. Today, global corporations enter and leave communities at will, shaping the futures of people, ecosystems, and the earth. Leaders of such corporations exercise sovereign control over vast lands, 80% of all land used for export agriculture, species, and minerals. They destroy local institutions of decision-making, along with cultural traditions and regional self-sufficiency. They choose which products and technologies are rewarded and created, and how human beings are used as workers and then discarded. They tax unilaterally and invisibly via administered pricing and spend large sums to instruct us what to believe, what to buy, and how to vote. Such concentrated corporate power that can manipulate our democratic processes is contrary to the theory of governance that is supposed to prevail in this republic. A revolution against tyrannical perpetual monarchy was waged in the name of this theory, that in the United States all power must be constitutional, that is, answerable to the people. But isn't it clear that we, the people, have little legal or moral authority over today's giant corporations? That many of us are not even conscious that people once exercised such authority with diligence and determination? And as Cornel West suggests, hasn't it become, quote, difficult to even imagine what a free and democratic society without such concentrations of corporate power would look like or how it would operate? So what can we do? For starters, in our communities and in our states, we can begin doing our work to stop obvious corporate harm in ways which, 1, reveal today's large corporations as illegitimate for self-governing people, as contrary to community stability and ecological sanity. 2, enable us via mass action, challenging lies and custom, to assert local authority over corporations and over Earth's assets, which corporate managers claim. 3, contest legal doctrines which are currently in vogue, like the ones declaring corporations to be persons protected by our Bill of Rights and granting to corporations the sole right to manage. 4, rewrite our state corporation laws to recharter corporations, that is, rework the legal relationships between our communities and the corporate fictions we allow to operate in our communities, and to redesign our institutions of enterprise. 5, freeze the assets and revoke the charters of harm-causing corporations whose managers and directors resist our constitutional authority over them. None of this will be easy, but what alternatives do we have? Can we bring about the transitions our communities and the Earth cry out for by organizing chemical by chemical, forest by forest, dump by dump, technology by technology, product by product, outrageous act by outrageous corporate act? We have enormous rethinking and organizing tasks ahead. But this is work which will be nurtured by struggle in communities and ecosystems where people in nature experience corporate tyranny most keenly. And it is work which will be fueled by a growing realization that democracy will continue to be a delusion as long as we allow corporations to rule. That article, Ending Corporate Governance, by Richard L. Grossman, those articles from the book Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, published in 2001 by the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, known as POCLAD. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Susan George is a political scientist, public scholar, and writer on global social justice, third world poverty, underdevelopment, and debt. She is a fellow and president of the board of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam and honorary president of Attac France, an organization that advocates taxation of international speculative financial transactions. In October, she spoke before an audience in Vienna on the topic, Where Did All the Money Go?
Susan George, I've read in the newspaper, in an interview with you, that you know where all the money has gone. And that, of course, is a question that interests all of us, and we all want to know, where has it gone? We know that states, governments, have spent enormous amounts of money in the past years. We know that some people have made enormous amounts of money on enterprises, on speculation. We know also that more people lost a lot of money. But money can't disappear, can it?
Well, when I first was asked to come to the Arbeiterkammer Wiener Gespräch, and they gave me the topic, where has all the money gone? And I thought that's a very good question, and it's worth thinking about. And it so happens that I have just completed quite a long text which does try to answer that question. Well, where has all the money gone? The first thing should be to explain that the money has gone up the social ladder, and it has got stuck at the top, and it is staying at the top, and people do not know that they have been literally robbed over the last 30 years. The banks are another question. Everybody knows that the money has been thrown at the banks, that they have had the most incredible windfall of cash, that they became, according to the standard phrase now, too big to fail. But I would like to ask a bit later, you know, why did they have to get all this money? Because it seems obscene. I mean, I think most people are really upset that the banks have been suddenly gifted with such enormous sums, because the governments always tell us, we don't have enough for education. You look at the students occupying the university now here. We don't have enough for proper health care. We don't have enough to fix this or that, whatever is needed for society. But the moment the banks get into trouble, they dig up in the back garden, or they find in the bottom drawer, I don't know where they get it, but they suddenly there's plenty of money. There's no problem.
There's also always the argument that the money is needed because otherwise the little people lose the money.
Yes.
So the money has to be given to the banks. Do I understand you right?
That's not what the banks are getting, because the little people, so to speak, in the U.S. are insured for $100,000. And in Europe, they are generally, I don't know if the legislation is the same everywhere, but they are generally insured for 100,000 euros. So this is a false argument. That's not the truth. But the final part I hope we'll be talking about is exactly what our friend the Vice President said in the introduction which is where ought the money to go and how can we reorient it? So let me start maybe with the kind of historical part about how the money has gone up. Working people used to, in the 70s, used to get about 74% of what economists call the value added. Every year in an economy, so much wealth is created. And working people, salaried people, used to get 74% and capital got 26%. And over the past 30 years, that has changed considerably, so that now the share of capital is 40% and the share of working people has gone down to 60%. Now, you can get, maybe there'll be some argument on that point here, because if there are economists present, you can always change that figure. Mine comes from Eurostat. And it depends what year you start with, it depends what time span you take, but I have never seen an estimate that said that the shift in income was less than 10%. So that has been taken out of working people's pockets. It's as simple as that. And when working people have less to spend, they don't buy as much, this is obvious. And then what happens to capital? Well, they can't sell as many goods. So we're constantly in a crisis of overproduction because they can't get rid of all their automobiles or all their cooking stoves or whatever. And it used to be in the golden age that maybe wasn't as golden as that, but we still think of the 60s and the 70s as a kind of golden age. And that was the period where what's called Fordism still worked. You remember Henry Ford used to say, I pay my workers so they can buy my cars. And now workers are not paid so they can buy the cars or the whatever they make. And it used to be that an American worker would have to put about 18 weeks of salary into an automobile. And now it's 28 or 30 weeks for the same class automobile. So people have been robbed in different ways as money has moved up in a general way from labor to capital. But it has also moved up in specific ways, which maybe we'll want to talk about, because frankly, I am sick of talking about the poor. You know, we have had statistics for years on how many people are living at less than a dollar a day and how many at less than $2. And now it's the Millennium Development Goals, none of which are going to be met in 2015. And all of the research institutions and the World Bank and the UN, and they go on and on and on about the poor. And every year, the poor are worse off. So I think it's high time we talked about the rich.
So we talked about the automobile workers. That's an industry, for example. That's the automobile industry. It's an industry that is subsidized heavily, as we see now in Germany, for example, with Opel. And you talked about overproduction. Is not that also a problem that has to be dealt with, that there's money being put into an industry which actually, in that form, is not apt to exist anymore and wasn't able to change produce products that are needed for ecological change. They've blocked that for years and years. And now, in the end, it's not only workers being paid less, but also workers having to contribute that the factories survive, maybe even factories that are not fit to survive.
Well, if I'm sure everyone here wants to give me absolute power tonight, so I'm going to take absolute power and I'm going to fix the world, right?
Afterwards, I'm going to ask you how you did it.
Yeah, right. But on that one, I think that we can look to the past. And when I read about Opel and General Motors and the other, Peugeot and all the rest of them, I thought, why don't they do what the Lucas Aerospace workers did 30 years ago? Probably a lot of people in the audience are much too young to remember anything about the Lucas Aerospace workers in Britain. But in the 1970s, the British company Lucas had 15 factories all over Britain, and they had decided to close 8 of those factories. And the workers, who belonged to about 15 different unions, because the British system is structured bizarrely, and they belonged to all these different unions, but what they decided to do together was to occupy the plants and to form a commission, mostly of shop stewards, who would, and they organized a new plan for their industry. They were making mostly weapons, almost entirely devoted to military production. And over 18 months, the workers, the engineers, the technicians, everybody participated, and they developed a plan which would have, it was so far ahead of its time that when you read it now, you are just astonished, because they invented ecological systems. This is more than 30 years ago, right? Ecological transport systems. They had tremendous experience with radar because of their military experience. So they invented things which would help the blind to see through a kind of perception, the deaf to hear, medical equipment, portable dialysis machines, wheelchairs that a disabled child could operate, road rail transport systems that could go off the road and onto the railway, and commute between communities that had no railways, etc., etc. And then it failed for various reasons, and the unions didn't agree, which I think it was a grave mistake, because perhaps they thought they were losing influence or something. But the labor government was against them, and the unions did not cooperate very much. Some of them did. But that's what I would have done with the money. We've spent centuries not allowing people to be creative. We did it for centuries with women. We left half the human race out of creativity, except in the kitchen, you know, having babies. And now we're still saying to workers, you don't have a right to be creative. And that's what I would have done with the money. I would have said, get on with it. You have 18 months' wages to invent something new, many things that are new. So I think that the idea of just handing over billions to keep the patient on life support without designing completely new systems is a mistake.
So in that, you would even be of the same opinion with neoliberals, who would maybe say, let them fail, let the market correct?
No, I'm not saying let them fail. I am saying let them invent the future, which I think is very different.
I'm sorry I distracted you from the question. You still didn't explain to us where the money went.
Well, yeah. Okay. I mean, I did want to talk about the rich, because here I have some things I don't think people know very well. And there have been a lot of studies about where the money went in terms of differences between countries. I mean, I can tell you that the United States, on average, has 72 times more than Malawi or Mali. Okay? I mean, I think we know these things pretty well. But what we don't necessarily know is that the top 10% of adults worldwide own 85% of global household wealth, and the richest 2% in the world have half that wealth. And the bottom 10% have less than the poorest half of the world population doesn't even have 1% of the wealth. So that is the first thing. I think everyone in this room, according to this study, is probably in the top 10% of humanity. Maybe you don't feel it that way. This particular study counts everything you have. It counts as wealth, the clothes you have on your back, the money you have on your in your pocket. If you have a refrigerator, that counts. I mean, it's everything. So probably all of us are in the top percent, 10%. But that means that we only have $61,000 worth of goods. And probably all of us, or maybe not the very young, but all of us have accumulated $61,000 worth of something. And the other thing that is not very well known is that it's not so much where you live, but it's where you are on the social ladder. And here, again, I'm sorry, I have to give a few figures, but when it's about money, you have to do figures. A third of all Brazilians are richer than the bottom 5% of Germans. And even more surprising, there are 200 million Chinese who are richer than the bottom 5% of Germans. So it's not so much where you live. It's really where you are in the society. And the gaps have got bigger over 30 years. And I say money is like champagne bubbles. You know, they go up, it goes up into the air. And it used to be that the...
But it doesn't really go up into the air, does it?
No, it goes
does
up into...
Does it ever disappear? No, it doesn't disappear.
No, it gets very, very concentrated, though. It gets... It's like a quintessence. It's like a pyramid. And at the top, it's so high up that the atmosphere is really rarefied. It's like the top of Mount Everest.
In one of your books, I read the thesis that that there's a law. I forgot the name of the law, but the law says 20% of the bookshops make 80% of the books. The 80-20 law.
Yeah, there's an 80-20 law, and that used to be true. It used to be true that 20% of the population had 80% of the wealth. 20% of the banks have 80% of the accounts, 20% of the bookshops sell 80% of the books, etc. It's amazing how many places this law works out. And it used to be that way, but now it is 10% has 90% of the wealth, not 80-20, but 10-90. So that is one example of how much the wealth has got concentrated. But I recommend to you to get onto internet and look up Merrill Lynch, Capgemini, the World Wealth Reports. They've been issuing these reports for 11 or 12 years now, and I always download them because Merrill Lynch, you know, it's a brokerage house. It was recently sold to the Bank of America because it was about to fail. But they're interested in money. They want to manage the money of these people. So they're not counting the clothes on your back and the books in your library and your refrigerator. They are counting what you've got in investable cash, okay? Because they want to manage it. And they have decided or determined in some way that throughout the world, even after the crisis, there are still 8.7 million people in the world who have, so 8,700,000 people, who together have 38 and some trillion dollars in wealth. And even better, and this shows how high the mountaintop goes and how thin the air is up there, among those 8.7 million people, there are 78,000 people, most of them in Europe, the U.S., and Japan, but more and more proportionally in Asia and Brazil and elsewhere. And those 78,000 people together have $13 trillion. Now, how much is $1 trillion? This is almost unimaginable. It is one trillion is 1 and 12 zeros. So it's easier to think of this in terms of your watch. If every second that your watch ticks is a dollar, to get to 1 trillion will take you 310 centuries, or 31,000 years. So that's how much is a trillion. And today in the world, we have the 78,000 people, this is still Merrill Lynch, the wealth managers talking, who have 13 trillion, which is the GDP of the entire European Union. Now we're talking real money, okay? Real money. And they lost a bit because they gamble a lot. You know, they gamble on securities. And they lost about 20% of their wealth between 2007 and 2008. So let us pause now and cry for those people. They are now not billionaires, they're only multimillionaires. But now that we have paused, I think we can say that, you know, when you are in that category, you have all the help you need to avoid paying taxes to anyone. You don't. You put your money in tax havens. You have lawyers, accountants, advisors.
Do you have a figure whether they pay anything? Or?
No. In one word, no, because nobody knows. What we do know is that there is corporate and private wealth probably on the order of 12 or 13 trillion in tax havens. These are used by most everybody who has money of some kind, and they're not just Europeans and North Americans. They're also Africans.
And these 78,000 people, are these people or are these individuals?
No, these are individuals.
These are individuals, yeah. Individual people. They're not
yes.
Corporations.
No.
They're
in Merrill Lynch's World Wealth Report, they have two categories. One is called high net worth individuals, and for that you have to have $1 million. And this is not $1 million in possessions. This is $1 million in investable cash. It's not your house, you know. It's not your wine collection or your pictures or your fine furniture or mansions or whatever.
Or virtual cash.
Yeah, it's real cash or the equivalent, something you can convert quickly. And the other category is the ultra high net worth individuals, but for that you have to get 30 million. So that, you know, that's the starting ticket. And it's the ultra high worth net worth individuals who have these 13 trillion, and they're just 1% of all those who are considered high net worth individuals. So every time you get about 1% of a given group, and then you can go even one higher, where you have about 800, 900 billionaires on the Forbes list.
And they do not pay tax for this.
And a lot of them don't pay tax. A lot of them pay very little tax compared. Look, I mean, when I was growing up in the United States, the top tax rate was 90%, and that was under a Republican president.
Eisenhower,
exactly. And now the top tax rate is 35%, and that is on anything above $350,000. So lots of people are richer than $350,000, and that means that they don't pay. We've spent 30 years reducing taxes on rich people. So that's one place that the money should be clawed back.
That's something that's little known in Europe, that I've read that in your book too, Eisenhower, these 90%.
Yeah.
Under Eisenhower, how was that socially accepted? Was that a post-war thing?
I think we don't know enough about the way the U.S. used to be. Because after the war, I mean, the country had been in such a state of solidarity during the war that everybody was contributing to the war effort. Children were contributing to the war effort. We had victory gardens. We saved our allowances to buy victory stamps. And when you got enough victory stamps, you could have a victory bond, and you would save it very carefully. And we had, everybody was working for the war effort. The conversion that took place over 2 years was absolutely astonishing. And when we talk about solutions, I will also bring in the fact that it was a society that was in solidarity. And one thing that happened was that the directors of large corporations were often named dollar-a-year men. And that meant that they were in charge of the quality and quantity targets that the government was setting, and that they got $1 a year from the United States Treasury for doing that work. And my godfather, a good friend of my parents, was the head of Goodyear Aerospace. And he was my godfather. And I was probably insufferable because I would tell all my little school friends that my godfather was a dollar a year man, and he, you know, because it was really prestigious. And so the society coming out of the war thought it was absolutely normal that returning veterans should get the GI Bill of Rights for education, that workers should be rewarded for what they had done for the war effort, that the thing that didn't work was that women were sent back to the kitchen. That was a definite minus. But the pluses were that it was seen as perfectly normal that we have a kind of welfare state. Now, not perfect, not as good as in Europe during the same period, but still, it was a very different country. I wrote a book which doesn't exist in German, which I called Hijacking America, which was published in 2007, to explain how the right had hijacked the country, how they had changed all of the ideology to neoliberalism.
That's a very interesting point, to how mentality of a whole country within 60 years can change to the extreme opposite, especially considering the New Deal that was before then.
Well, the New Deal was certainly the country would not have survived without Franklin Roosevelt. But if you contrast Roosevelt and Obama, and let me say, like everybody else I know, I was extremely moved when Obama was elected. I was there at 4:30 in the morning, and I was weeping and, you know, praise the Lord and so on. I mean, it was just, when he took Ohio and Pennsylvania, I said, okay, I can go to bed, you know, and I was, anyway. But Roosevelt, in one of his final campaign speeches in New York at Madison Square Garden, which is the biggest sports arena in New York, and he said, he was speaking about the bankers, and he said, this class hates me, and I welcome their hatred.
Well, they did hate him, didn't
they? And they did hate him. They called him that man. You did not say Franklin Roosevelt in front of women and children. You called him that man. And Obama said the other day, he was at a fundraiser a couple of weeks ago in New York, and he said, I don't have it written here, but it was approximately, if there are members of the financial community here this evening, let me ask you not to fight necessary reforms, but support them. Now, I mean, you don't beg the bankers to support necessary reforms. I'm sorry. They're not going to do it. They're simply not going to do it. And when we were thinking tonight, I would start off with a long, probably boring speech. I wanted to start with a quotation, which I use and like a lot. And I'm going to ask at least the front rows where I can see people, because at the back I can't see you. If it's familiar, and if you, and also you, I mean, if you think you know who wrote it. And this person said, all for ourselves and nothing for other people. seems in every age of the world to have been the vile maxim of the masters of mankind. Now that's first, it's very good prose, very muscular writing. I like that. But does anybody have an idea who could have said, all for ourselves and nothing for other people, in every age of the world has been the vile maxim of the masters of mankind? Good for you. First try. Are you a professor of economics? Maybe.
Nearly, he said.
Nearly. Well, most people say, bravo, huh? Because most people say Marx first, and then they say maybe Machiavelli, and then they say maybe
Nietzsche.
Thomas Hobbes. And
Nietzsche, maybe.
Nietzsche, yeah. But it was Adam Smith. And he goes on to say, as you will know, but the rest don't, so I'll turn to this side. He goes on to say, and when the great proprietors of England were able to spend all of their wealth themselves, they preferred to have a pair of diamond buckles for their shoes or something as futile and useless rather than to support 1,000 men for a year or pay for the upkeep of 1,000 men for a year. And it's the same today. And lots of time, I mean, I generally speak to quite decent people. I mean, you know, there are not a lot of nasty people in my audiences. They tend to be sympathetic and they tend to be honest.
One never knows, though.
And so it's hard, but a lot of questions are, you know, but isn't there a point where they say enough, you know, it's enough, I have enough. And unfortunately that point isn't, you know, that there isn't a point like that.
When you said before that it was the American right that hijacked America, and, mm-hmm. and I thought that it was also partly the Clinton administration that was very much responsible for deregulation. For example, in media, but also economic deregulation. That wasn't only Reagan, it was in the Clinton years just the same. And that wasn't the left as we, and that wasn't the right as
we see it. No, the Clinton administration, like the socialists in France, privatized more and deregulated more than the George Bush one. George Bush the First had done before. So you're absolutely right. And one of the reasons that the banks have got so rich and that they have been receiving so much money is that they lobbied, they spent, so that's another place the money has gone, they spent $5 billion on lobbyists. They still have, I think, 3,000 lobbyists, and over a short period, six years, they spent $5 billion. And part of that was campaign contributions, and part of that was simply paying people to arrange deregulation for them. They got 12 different regulatory measures utterly changed. And a lot of that happened under Clinton.